Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's show, we feature faculty and student researchers and authors from Censored 2019, Fighting the Fake News Invasion. We focus on what corporate media spend their precious airtime on, rather than covering substantive, newsworthy issues. Today, we'll look at junk food news of entertainment, infotainment, blurred lines, and clickbait. On today's Project Censored Show, stay tuned.
Political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, of the apocalypse, got the skies looking ominous.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we are featuring a segment on so-called junk food news. This is a feature that Project Censored has been running in our books going back to the 1990s, in a phrase coined by founder Carl Jensen. In the 1980s, we'll talk more about the definitions, but first, let me introduce today's guests on the program. We're joined by Izzy Snow, who is a researcher and author and student at College of Marin. She contributed to Chapter 2 in Censored 2019, which is called Blurred Lines and Clickbait on Junk Food News. Izzy Snow, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
We are also joined by Christina Hamilton. She is also a researcher and author and contributor to Censored 2019 on the Junk Food News chapter. She is also a student at College of Marin in Northern California. Christina, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thanks, Mickey.
And last but surely not least, we are joined by Dr. Susan Rahman, who is a professor of sociology, behavioral sciences at College of Marin. She is our affiliates person from College of Marin that works with Project Censored every year, both on the Validated Independent News and our first chapter for Top Stories. Also, of course, the last couple of years has been overseeing the Junk Food News chapter. And of course, Susan Rahman, among the many other things she does. She is on the board of the Media Freedom Foundation as vice president. She has also contributed to previous Censored volumes and focuses much of her research on issues surrounding Palestine. Susan Rahman, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Mickey. It's nice to be here.
So whichever of you likes to start and jump in, we're going to have an hour conversation about everything junk food news. So why don't we just start by telling our listeners and reminding them, what do we mean by junk food news? Izzy?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Carl Jensen created the term junk food news in 1982 as sensationalized news stories began to gain prominence. Censored 2019 notes that these were, quote, empty calorie stories that often crowded out the kind of real investigative journalism required to maintain a healthy democracy. Junk food news is news from sources that are purely devised to be entertaining and not informative. You don't really learn anything about policy or the global social issues of the world when you read them. The experience of digesting an entirety of an e-news website is the same as that rotten feeling in your stomach after gorging on an entire bag of potato chips, so experiencing it and enjoying it is a lot like eating junk food news.
Indeed, and you're reminding me of Dr. Andy Lee Roth, our associate director, co-editor of the Censored Volumes and the Censored Movie, who talked about junk food news being akin to Pringles.
Right? Yeah, you pop them back one by one and you feel sick after, but you're still hungry a few minutes later.
So now that we have this definition for junk food news, thank you, Izzy, for that definition. And of course, Susan Rahman chiming in. One of you might want to talk a little more about how have you seen this developing, given that you've been researching this, you've contributed to the Censored Annual Volumes from Seven Stories Press. Since Carl talked about junk food news, has this problem grown? Has it gotten worse? What are your views on this based on your research?
I definitely think that it's gotten a lot worse with proliferation of different media now with the internet and social media. It excels more and there's a lot more at stake for media outlets to actually get audiences. And instead of being about actually doing a service for the public by informing them of important news sources, is more about the money. So the business aspect of it actually makes it so that they have to chase down those like sensationalist stories to get the readership or the viewership. It could be fun. I had a whole point in my life where I loved gossip news. I loved like the e-stuff, Perez Hilton, stuff like that. It is frothy and junky, and it's just escapist in a way because it doesn't really matter. The problem is when that's your only source for any kind of news, and it's so, so easy to actually funnel that in and just stay in that zone.
You know, again, we have our guilty pleasures. Some people like sports. Some people like this kind of gossip news or entertainment, right? But one of the big challenges we've seen over the last few decades is the infotainment, the blurred lines of entertainment and information, right? And it's what Neil Postman called in the mid-1980s. He was saying that we were amusing ourselves to death. Are we there yet? Susan Rahman, why don't you jump into the conversation here? Say a few words about some of the things that you teach and how you present this to your students. And again, every year we're so fortunate to have so many fantastic students that come through your classes that contribute to the book. It's not just that they're learning for their own behalf. They're sharing what they're learning and they're showing their skills in published works.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable to have this experience and to meet these students who really dig into the material. This idea that we do entertain ourselves with media in one form or another, really a bulk of our day is spent in some form of tech or media, looking at a screen. And so what kinds of things are people looking at? Often it is junk food. And so having students in class who understand that that is a big part of their reality, but then able to take that next kind of critical analysis and say, okay, well, this is interesting. This is everywhere I turn, I'm seeing it on my laptop, I'm hearing it on the radio, I'm seeing it on my phone. If I turn on the television, I'm seeing it there. But what is that doing for me? What am I learning as a result of this? And so that piece where maybe they're questioning that is something that I hope to get across in the classroom with them. And I think that's the critical media literacy that we do in the classes that involve Project Censored, certainly, but in terms of like critical thinking in general as part of an undergraduate education, how do students look at all of this? Because there's so much information out there, and how do we look at it? How do we decide what's important, what's meaningful? And I think a lot of the things that they're also touching on is what they're not learning by paying attention to this junk food kind of mantra that's played over and over again. And hopefully what they're learning as a result of using independent news sources then opens a door into that reality as well. I see that as a social justice tool, you know, in terms of how we understand learning more about what kind of global social issues or social problems or whatever you want to term them are out there. It's almost as if you can't fault people for not working towards change if they don't know that there's a change that needs to happen, right? And I think that junk food does a really good job of distracting people to the point where they're not looking at the other stuff. And, you know, as a Marxist sociologist, I might think that that is by design. But whether it is or it isn't, the point is that students then have an opportunity to check out. And we know what'll happen. We might even be living in some of that right now, checking out kind of reality and what happens in terms of human rights and all the things that get kind of squashed when we don't stand up and ask for what it is we think is important.
Definitely, Susan. And I think you hit on a really important point, which is that the most dangerous element of junk food news is that they turn the reader into a passive consumer. Junk food news stories are designed to protect corporate interests, and they work to slowly remove agency for the viewer. So if you empower a student with an independent news and media freedom and media literacy education, it encourages the viewer to be an active and engaged citizen. Independent news sources are not beholden to corporate interest and paint a more vivid factual picture of the current global social issues, which is key to understanding the different ways in which internet culture has influenced how we carry ourselves today and how we make decisions about the sort of society. If we're so passive that we are unable to be active in our communities, a lot of stuff goes by without us even recognizing what's going on.
To jump in there, Izzy, and build off what you're saying about passivity versus being an active consumer, I definitely noticed this with myself as well. One thing, like Mickey, you said earlier about how we were able as students to go out and share our work, not just in books and everything on the website. I'm able to talk with my family, my friends, my coworkers, to have conversations with them. And then they're like, oh, yeah, like they don't know what junk food is, and I explain it. Like, oh, then they have five examples off the top of their heads that they could bring up. Like if it's a Kardashian or Jenner or whatever. I'd had one coworker, Paul. He actually went right on his phone on Google, and he just went through the first five Google stories he saw in the news, and four of them were just straight up entertainment. One wasn't significant, but again, like he got the message like right away, which was very cool. But when I did the same thing to go on my little Chrome on my Android, what I noticed was that I didn't get any news at all. I got all like things about Netflix shows. Because again, you're not really aware that Chrome is so, it's like using those algorithms to just keep you with what you're interested in. And again, it's like, unless you're actually searching for those things, you're not going to really be aware of it. And it's so much easier just to kind of let those things go on the wayside and not seek out things.
Definitely. And I think you hit on a good point, which is that the internet culture has made it so that there are blurred lines between what junk food news is and what clickbait news is and what actual important news is. And corporate media tries to sell bite-sized news or news that waters down the complexities of nuanced topic to mere sound bites and GIFs in order to engage their viewers because we're so plugged into this internet culture. These days, we're expected to fit knowledge into an 140-character count. So it's all about the GIFs, the retweets. It becomes more about the eyeballs on the screen than the thoughts and ideas behind them.
Indeed, you just mentioned in terms of the Twitter count, I think that they doubled the characters in the last couple of years or so. So, wow, we can maybe have a 15-second idea going on, right? That's somehow celebratory. Interestingly enough, based on all of the things that you were just saying, I think, too, that this really underscores an important part of, I would say, not just critical media literacy, but civic literacy and participatory literacy that is apparently not being taught very much in the K-12 programs, right? Susan, you might want to jump in with some of this, that we both teach community college and we teach college university level. And it's pretty amazing that the students that are coming to us, what Christina was saying a moment ago, when you're explaining to people where you work, you happen to work at a fantastic independent local bookstore.
I work at Copperfields Books.
Indeed. And we need more local independent bookstores.
We definitely
do. We surely do. A big part of community education, it's not just happening in the schools. And if it isn't happening in the K-12, unless you're lucky enough to have a teacher that brings it in, it's just not part of the standard curriculum. But this kind of nuts and bolts education is part of civic literacy that is necessary for people to grow up to understand how to be engaged and where to engage and how to choose what's important to them in their community. Susan?
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of the education model that we currently kind of fall under, certainly in this country, it misses the mark in terms of creating the whole person. You know, we do a lot of compartmentalizing of you need to learn this math equation, you need to learn this piece of history, you need to learn how to write a 5-paragraph essay. But what are we teaching K-12 students in terms of how to live in the world? It's remarkable that there's not a lot of emphasis on living skills, life skills, because as a college teacher, when I send these students off, I feel like this is only one piece of the whole person that you're going to become or that you are in the moment, but you need so much more. And so take this as part of who you are and keep it in your pocket. But remember that there's much more to being a human in the world and to interact with other people. And I feel like we don't do that enough in terms of how we educate the kids from the very young age up to coming into college. Because I certainly know that Project Censored often is like just a mind-blowing experience for students when they start working on this project. It feels like, wow, I've never even like imagined that I should be critical of the media I'm consuming, which to me seems shocking. But that's because I do it for my job.
It was very shocking. I remember, Susan, being in your class and feeling like the veil was lifted. It was incredibly empowering, and I didn't even realize that I could have a voice, because especially with young people growing up now in the midst of internet culture, it's very about the personal brand versus the ideas behind them. It's all about how you present yourself and not how you choose to express yourself, and you empowered us with that capability. And it's almost like I was a victim of censorship, or that young people are being censored all of the time and they're not able to empower themselves with the agency that they need to be an active citizen in the world, because I didn't even realize I could have a voice or that I could use it. And you empowered me with that. So I'm incredibly grateful and I feel very lucky, because that isn't common for young people.
We're fortunate at Project Censored to work with so many amazing students and young people. They're not all young people. We have students from many different ages and demographics that come back to us. Susan and I teach at community college as well as university. We have a really diverse group of people with different experiences, and it's really interesting to see across the spectrum how students in the classroom also help teach each other. almost like learning communities, right? I'd like to remind everyone that you're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We have in studio with us today two fantastic student researchers and authors, contributors to Censored 2019, Fighting the Fake News Invasion. They contributed to the Junk Food News chapter. We have Izzy Snow and Christina Hamilton. We also have Professor Susan Rahman with us, who oversaw the research of that chapter with them. After this brief musical break, we're going to come back and we're going to focus on that research and we're going to dive in and hear about what they wrote about for Censored 2019. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we're focusing on one of the many facets that Project Censored works on in our critical media education programs and our critical pedagogy towards social justice. And this is the focus on infotainment culture, and particularly what we call junk food news. Today in studio, we have Izzy Snow, Christina Hamilton, students at College of Marin that were researchers and authors contributing to Chapter 2 of Censored 2019, Fighting the Fake News Invasion. The chapter is titled Blurred Lines and Clickbait. There's another word in the subtitle the FCC won't allow me to say on air. It's the S-hole that is junk food news, riffing on President Trump's commentary, the very disparaging negative comments he made about African countries. I'm sure our listeners can piece together what that word is. But let's start here just with you, Susan Rahman. Just explain to us, how do you go about presenting this chapter? How do you go about sharing the information with students about just getting them started and giving them a template or an outline where they can then jump in and explore and discover what's going on around them?
For the class that we write this chapter in, I've already introduced them to the project. Students are writing VINs, and I'll just redirect you for a second because Izzy Snow also wrote a VIN, so if you know, you can check in on that. But so validated independent news stories, they start the process there where they're hunting down independent news sources, hunting down stories that they find significant, and then they're doing what we call a summary VIN that they turn in and that gets thrown into the mix for the candidate stories for the top 25. So they've already had an experience with an understanding of what independent news is as opposed to corporate media. So they're at the point where they're kind of more savvy than just coming in from nothing. Then we kind of flip it. So this junk food news idea is like, what is in the news that is just so absurd, but it's just taking up a lot of space, right? And so I usually leave it to them to come up with the junk because actually they probably know more than me about what is junk and what is out there. It's actually really fun for me to hear like, okay, what's the latest? And then they come in with these absurd stories. And so we usually work in small groups, you know, maybe three or four students on a story, and the chapter usually takes up about four or five stories in general. The idea behind junk food is that it's entertaining and it's absurd, so we highlight those stories. But the backstory, or the part that is the critical media literacy piece, is then what is it that we're not talking about in relation to that, and what is taking up the space so that we can't even really see the other thing going on. And so the first part for them is to gather the junk, which again doesn't seem like it's that hard, right? The junk is easy to find. And then we do a little deeper dive about, well, okay, so let's look at topically, what is that junk? And then how do we look and see what sort of relates to it that isn't being covered? And so we'll talk about that as we're talking today. But there's definitely a lot that's not being covered. And that's where the indie news sources come into play. So we match them up. So a group will have the junk piece, and then they'll also have the indie piece, and they'll describe the junk piece, and then meanwhile, here's what you're missing.
What I really liked about this, though, is that we were able to find, like, stories that are both junk food and substantial stories that actually have, like, a theme or connection with them, which was also very fun and creative, and I wasn't expecting that as well. Like, Izzy, your story was about the dog that died on the airlines, right? And then you were able to find something else about United Airlines that had actually a far more important effect on the world and on our personal lives and everything. And I thought that was really interesting.
For our story, when we were selecting the junk food news stories, we picked two stories that were in the media news landscape at the same time, but one was given significant more attention than the other. So the story that me and my partner Kyle Zucker chose is about the puppy that died in the overhead bin of the United Airlines flight. While this story exposed animal cruelty, it continued to dominate the headlines for an unnecessary amount of time. What was and is deeply ironic about this story is that it focuses on one instant of animal abuse while thousands of people are trafficked into this country and abused as modern-day slaves. So Kyle and I focused on the Frontline documentary from April 2018 that profiled a group of Guatemalan teens. These teens were lied about the opportunities in the U.S. Then they were forced to work in horrible conditions on a trillium egg farm in Ohio to pay off their $15,000 trafficking fee. So while one story that dominated the headlines explored one case of exploitation, human exploitation goes on in this country all the time for thousands and thousands of people, and it just illustrates how much censorship is designed to protect corporate interests, because Trillion Egg Farm doesn't want you to know where it gets its workers from, but it has a history of abuse that censorship is covering up.
And it also highlights the point that there are certain people that are here doing a lot of work that don't rate enough to be cared about in the corporate media. I think the contrast that you found with those two stories was really telling. I always say people care more about sad dogs than they do about migrant workers. And to me, that's just highly unfortunate. Not that I don't love dogs. Don't tell everyone Susan doesn't like dogs, because I love dogs. But humans are being violated, abused, and mistreated on a daily basis. And that is not something that the corporate media is covering on a regular basis.
Definitely. And I think you highlight an interesting point, which is the most outrageous and popular junk food news stories in the 2017 to 2018 cycle exploited our gender, racial, and socioeconomic identities that divide us rather than unite us. That's why these stories are able to gain prominence in the landscape, because they are outrageous and they try to attack sort of qualities that divide us, whereas encouraging the empathy and humanity that is needed to move forward.
You know, I think this goes to the root of really what pushed Carl Jensen, the founder of Project Censored. It really pushed him to open up this categorical analysis. The early criticisms of Project Censored, which was founded in 1976 at Sonoma State University, coming from journalists, included people saying, and this is before cable news and before the internet, right? So, you know, it might as well be a million years ago for people born after in 2000. These people came to Jensen, who had a career in media, and they said, you know, that's not necessarily fair that you're saying that we're censoring stories. We just use news judgment. And this is back when you don't have the infinite 24/7 news cycle. There's precious column inches and 30-minute network news and that kind of thing. And so Carl, to his credit, said, well, okay, that might be a fair critique. So that's when he said, let me take a look at what you are covering, not just what you're not covering. And then that's what led him to coin junk food news. He's like, if the precious column inches are so prized to you, what are you doing filling them with garbage about O.J. Simpson's chase or the equivalents of Jenner's or Kardashian's or gossip stuff? And again, we have news media that is entertainment media and gossip media and so on. But what we're looking at coming through the last 30, 40 years is how much that has bled over into actual allegedly hard-hitting news.
Hence the title of the chapter, Blurred Lines. I mean, if not now, more than ever, there's certainly this news porn stuff that's going on in terms of, it was interestingly difficult to find the line. Like, is it junk? Is it not junk? It's sort of junky, but maybe we need to know this. I mean, we figured it out, but it's certainly been blurred to the degree that our president is a reality show star and we're looking at Jeff Bezos's junk, those kinds of things. But mm-hmm. then what's important about those is that there's also decisions being made to benefit or not benefit most of humanity. And so how do we dig into one piece and not dig into others? And the convenience of the blurred lines is that we can focus on something absurd so that we're not looking at that same person's heinous acts.
It's as if we're in a hyper-reality TV show now. I mean, again, it's almost every day in the headlines. Michael Avanti, the attorney from Stormy Daniels, mm-hmm. is now up on new charges. I mean, again, it's almost as if we can't – it's the thing we don't want to look at and can't turn away from. And the blurred line element also is something that led the second director of the project, Peter Phillips, to create a news abuse section – very specifically because of the exact tightrope right. walk you discussed.
Yeah.
Is it newsworthy? Yes, it is, but not the way the corporate media is covering it. This year in the 2019 book, Susan Rahman, you and your students helped us separate the news abuse and junk food news chapters.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it really helps people see more clearly something that is blurred and something that, but it's something that is far more common. Izzy, Christina, what can you add to that? In your experience of researching that, tell us about some of your thought processes and some of what went on in the stories that you looked at. Maybe how you chose the stories.
I had a group, and one person had the great idea about doing Stormy Daniels, and she was the one who kind of brought it up with us. And we were like, that sounds great. We'll do it. The thing was, though, just like you're saying, news abuse, the Stormy Daniels payoff and everything was part of such a huge factor because it actually could have been a federal offense, the payoff that Michael Cohen did. And of course, now everyone knows Michael Cohen. They know Stormy Daniels, and it's honestly so surprising that we wrote this like a year ago, and now these people are still in the news for all these reasons. Like you said, Michael Avenatti, who is
extorting Nike, allegedly.
Garagos, another celebrity lawyer. So it's just all this stuff, and it just never really goes away. And that's another thing, too, that was surprising for me. Even after we were done writing it, you think, okay, book is literally closed. We're done, but you never really move on. This stuff has repercussions. My group focused on the Stormy Daniels thing and just the aspect of the entertainment again. Well, what about these other things going on? What about the payoff? What about the actual criminal offenses that this is suggesting? But no, you're just focusing on this one porn star. The other part, the more legitimate part that we focused on, was this big bill called FOSTA SESTA. Stop Enabling Sex Trafficking Act is the SESTA part that was in the Senate version. It passed because it's supposed to help stop human trafficking. Who would want to say no to that? But a lot of sex workers, consensual sex workers, and ACLU and other organizations for like human rights and everything were actually against this because it would actually endanger not only consensual sex workers, but also the actual victims of trafficking.
I just want to remind listeners that the SESTA is Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act, SESTA, and that passed 97-2 in the Senate. The other was FOSTA. And it says here that it's the Allow States and Victims to Fight Online Sex Trafficking Act. So our listeners can track those.
Yes. Thank you, Mickey. So anyway, again, it seems like a good thing that you'd want to support, but it actually would make traffickers go underground and make it so that consensual sex workers would not have the safe safety networks that they put for themselves online. But a lot of places like Craigslist and Reddit, a lot of sex workers would have their own communities where they would help each other and look out for each other. And these were taken away because, of course, this bill that passed around the same time Cohen's office was raided by the FBI the first time.
Michael Cohen,
yeah. Yes.
So you were mentioning Cohen and the raiding of the office and so on. It's also the case that Democrat in the Senate from Oregon, Ron Wyden, said that FOSTA SESTA is an enormous chilling of free speech. So that was another one of the components of this.
What this bill was going to do and has done is make it so that people can actually sue those websites. And so to protect themselves, they ended up dropping a lot of different boards like Reddit and Craigslist, those places where sex workers or even just the traffickers that they're trying to find, they go further underground. So they're harder to find for the people to prosecute and find and actually do what it purported to do. And the thing is, too, again, like I wouldn't have known about this unless I did this project and went into this class and did this. I had no idea about it because, again, it's not reported in the news. And then I've been periodically going through it and like looking at FOSTA SESTA online and seeing, well, what's being done? Is it actually having these repercussions that we wrote about in the book and said that people were worried about? And it actually has had an adverse effect. There was a Rolling Stone article a few weeks ago where they're talking about journalists asking Democratic hopefuls about decriminalizing sex work because New York is trying to decriminalize it. And Bernie Sanders, he said, I don't have an answer for that. And Kamala Harris, who actually supported FOSTA SESTA and was against decriminalizing sex work in California, she was like, yeah, I'm supporting of it. But then there's like nothing to really show for that because, again, she is a huge supporter of FOSTA SESTA and sees it as like this huge success. But really, in effect, it's actually harmful to people and not doing what it's supposed to be doing.
Definitely. And I think what Christina discovered and what I noticed when we were editing the chapter is that the Stormy Daniels story is an excellent example of how fake woke news sources are basically just cleverly disguised junk food news or censorship that prioritize blitzy media blitz headlines over important issues such as Sesta Fosta. And Christina and I talked about how all of these celebrity sponsorships were tied to the passing of Sesta Fosta. And so this like fake woke news sources that aim to tell stories that are progressive values but are actually just more junk food news and a more sinister form of censorship are blurring the lines between junk food news and more important investigative news. And one of the ways in which they do this is that they commodify anger and activism. Righteousness is a gif or a call out or a 30-second video of Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez is not an investigative or fact-based news story. It's about commodifying anger and activism.
Very important points. Thank you for sharing that. And again, if you want to read more about what Christina and Izzy were just talking about, it's in Chapter 2 of Censored 2019, Fighting the Fake News Invasion. Susan Rahman, the professor teaching the class and helping oversee the research and put the chapter together. I'd like to remind listeners you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. After this brief musical break, we'll return and continue talking about junk food news. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we're looking at Project Censored's junk food news. We are very fortunate to have a couple of the student author and researchers in studio with us today. We are joined by Izzy Snow and Christina Hamilton, who contributed to Blurred Lines and Clickbait in Censored 2019, Fighting the Fake News Invasion on Junk Food News. We're also joined by Dr. Susan Rahman, professor at College of Marin, that helps oversee the students doing the research and writing of this chapter, and of course also our validated independent news and underreported chapters and many other things, and we'll talk a little bit more about some of that in this segment. But I wanted to go back to our junk food news topic, because one of the things that goes on in the writing of this chapter, I used to work on this chapter with a lot of students in previous censored volumes, and one of the things that we did is that we took liberty to be a little more pithy. That's P-I-T-H-Y. In other words, we didn't hesitate to take blogger-like pot shots at some of the people in the corporate media that clearly are educated to know better than to chase these clickbait headlines and stories. I mean, perhaps they're also doing the bidding of their paymasters, boards of directors, CEOs, advertisers, et cetera, to invoke the propaganda model here and how that shapes news and information. But one of the things that I know that I had a good time doing with my students, and this was one of their favorite parts, was coming up with like the catchy titles, the catchy headlines, the double entendres, the things that really poked at what was going on in the story. Earlier, Izzy, you were talking about the story, the sad story about the puppy, and your subtitle for that is Puppy Eyes Before Human Rights. And that's, well, that's that kind of sums that section up. And then the last section that you all were talking about regarding Fosta Sesta was Sex Lies and Shark Week, right? That was another one of the titles. So, and there's several other things that you all talk about here, including one of my favorite epigraphs in the entire book. People that read Censored for a long time knows what a fan of these we are. And you all started it out with a great quote from the comedian and social critic Michelle Wolf from the 2018 White House Correspondents' Dinner. You want to read it for us, Izzy?
Yeah, so I picked the quote because I thought it just perfectly articulated the reality of the, whatever you want to call it, post-truth, subjective truth world. Is the fact that at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, the dinner where the White House press is celebrated, Michelle Wolf comes out and has this incredible joke where she says to the White House correspondents at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. You guys love breaking news, and you did it. You broke it. Good work. The most useful information on CNN is when Anthony Bourdain tells me where to get noodles. So here, Michelle Wolf notes that CNN loves to churn out catchy headlines to get viewers, but if every story is treated with the same severity, this will not differentiate between the more important news and the fluffy junk food news stories.
Indeed. And you have a few more in this chapter. Would you like to share with our listeners a little bit about a couple of the other stories? You can go into as much or little detail as you want. Just to share with our listeners the research that you all did. And you know, look, I want to make sure our listeners also know that putting together these books every year is really a lot of work. It takes place over a period of a few months. It's no small feat to be putting together a chapter this size, let alone the rest of the book that we all work with hundreds of students and scores of professors on 15 campuses across the country. And of course, in this chapter, you know, there are one, two, three, four, about six or seven different student contributors, right, that you all worked with. So if there's something else you want to share with us, what are a couple of the other things that you all looked at?
The junk food news chapter identifies the most important stories from the 2017-2018 news cycle that were overshadowed by superficial, sensationalized media blitz. One of these stories, which is under the subsection Sticks and Stones, but FCC Hall has hurt SAFA. So this story focused on the coverage of Trump's FCC Hall comment in January 2018. The piece itself explored how the coverage of the FCC Hall comment, which lasted for the first few months of 2018, overshadowed the coverage of the Securing America's Future Act, or SAFA. The FCC Hall comment exposes Trump's racism, but SAFA is a form of institutional racism that attempts to criminalize DACA recipients and gives law enforcement more power. So we explored that in that subheading. And then we had another one that discussed the Kylie Jenner baby gossip story. It was called Keep Up with Kylie and Neglect Black Infant Mortality. So this section discussed how the black infant mortality crisis was virtually ignored by the press while they focused on Kylie Jenner's pregnancy rumors and then her baby. The black infant mortality crisis reveals the ways in which structural, institutional, and social racism affect the pregnancies of black women and the mortality of their infants. The book notes that groups such as Black Lives Matter and Showing Up for Racial Justice call attention to the racial disparity of black infant mortality, while the corporate press continues to neglect the issue in favor of celebrity baby talk. And then we included the Sex, Lies, and Shark Week story and the Puppy Eyes Before Human Rights. But an interesting point that I want to talk about, which we talk about in the discussion, is the chapter itself begins with the quote, "The reality TV president has found his reality TV press." So we discuss the ways in which Trump is very much the white whale of junk food news, as his goal is to entertain and not to inform the public. And this articulates the post-truth subjective truth and the ways that he galvanizes fake news to censor important dissenting voices.
Susan Rahman, why don't we bring you back into the conversation here, since you were the maestro conductor over the chapter and the students went out and played their parts.
They did.
They really did. They've
really
done such a fantastic job. And you always do such a great job helping and lead the way. What do you think about the work that they did? And I know you're doing this again right now this year for Censor 2020 through the Looking Glass. I mean, again, really important work.
I think they did a remarkable job. I think it was just a really amazing effort on the part of a good majority of them to really pull their weight and to come up with some great content and whip it into shape. That was a team effort to do that. But in general, I mean, I think it's a really fun project for them because, as you said, it's pithy, it's fun, it's sarcastic. It is poking fun at all of the things that we imagine to be academia or news for that matter. And so
good satire.
Yeah, it's good satire. It's funny because when we first start out doing Project Censored type stuff, they're like, wait, this isn't the 5-paragraph essay. This isn't the whatever. And I'm like, no, it's something different. Let's go this way. And at first, it's a little foreign to them. And then once they kind of dig their teeth into it, they're like, this is really neat. And so being able to joke in a written form was really a neat experience for them. And I'm getting ready to do it again. We're gearing up for junk food in about a week in the class that I'm teaching right now. And the homework is go tell me what the junk is, right?
Go turn on the TV.
Yeah. They're like, oh, this is the homework? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Come back with the junk. And so we're thinking through that right now. But I think just in general, having the ability to churn out this piece of published material is a gift to them in so many ways. I mean, it's a gift to all of us. If you care about media literacy and if you appreciate the work that independent journalists do, then this sings to you. It sings to people. Clearly, I'm in that category. I find this to be very meaningful work. But I think having this opportunity for students is really unique. So, I mean, if there's faculty out there listening, this is really an amazing project to do with students. It empowers them. Izzy said earlier she didn't know she had a voice. I mean, I think that's the biggest crock of media in general. Go back to the five filters. Go back to Chomsky and Herman. Think about who gets to be a voice, who gets to be newsworthy. I call FCC, you know what, on that, because I think everybody can be a journalist. I mean, I know everyone can be a journalist. I know everybody can tell a story. And so this kind of shows students that they actually are valuable and that their words matter and that there's a place for them to make news. And I mean, I know we have social media and I know there's those opportunities, but this is a formalized opportunity through the project, a vetted organization that then speaks truth to power and highlights these student voices in a way that is very profound and I think very life-changing. I mean, I think for students who have done this and found it to be meaningful, you know, you talk to them 20 years later and they're still like just really enamored with the experience and perhaps have been changed forever. I mean, if you think about Doug Hecker, who's one of the filmmakers from the second Project mm-hmm. Censored film, he harkens back to his days at Sonoma State when he did Project Censored with Peter Phillips in a sociology class. And he said, that changed me. And since then, he's been a diehard supporter of the project and has helped produce and make the documentary and continues to work and sits on the board. It's really an amazing project. And I feel really honored that I get to be a part of it. And I really, really enjoy sharing it with my students. It's one of those things where it doesn't sit well with top-down teaching. It's a more collaborative effort. And for me, that's the way I enjoy teaching anyways. And so to be able to share ideas and to work as a team, they teach me, I teach them. Mm-hmm. And then we bring our work out and share it with other people. And I just think it's a nice model.
Talk about social justice pedagogy, you know, and the idea that people have equal voice and everyone's there working together for a greater cause, for something bigger than all of us. And everybody contributes something different and unique. Echoing what you just said, Susan Rahman, I feel incredibly privileged to be able to work with so many great students and other faculty and in other people in the community. It's really amazing. And I want to say, too, that, you know, this print book is by Seven Stories Press out of New York. This is a respected independent publisher. This is a real hold in your hand hard copy book. That's academic, not in the pejorative sense, but in a substantive sense.
Absolutely.
And that these undergraduate students are also getting material that they can put on their CV and their resume and their experiences in public speaking. I mean, this is a real service learning opportunity.
100%. And I think that the ways in which the Project Censored philosophy, pedagogy, whatever you want to call it, has been brought into my classroom has been highly, highly academic, I guess you could say, but also just really empowering for students. You know, the other thing that I didn't talk about yet is that this group of students from last year hosted the biannual conference at College of Marin. And if you're talking about stuff that goes on a CV, mm-hmm. this is something that these students, they're conference planners, organizers, workshop leaders. I had to be a teacher for 10 years before I could put that on my CV. And so just the work that went into that, the collaborations with people all over the country and even some international people coming in, bringing ideas, sharing ideas, hosting a conference. I mean, they sat with me and we went through all the proposals and we organized the structure and we read their proposals. This was a lot of really hands-on work in order to prepare this conference. And it turned out to be a delightful experience, I think, for most people. I think for the most part, it was a really neat experience. And the coming together of the intergenerational learning, mm-hmm. which I think is something that, again, our education system is missing.
where we all could sit at the table, where we all could have a voice and we could all talk about what we do and we could all look at each other and go, oh, that's really neat. I really like what you're doing. Wow, that's cool. I might try that. And I think there's just so much opportunity for academic growth as well as personal growth and some social justice.
This was Media Freedom Summit 2.0, the Critical Media Literacy for Social Justice that was held at College of Marin late October. And I know we've aired a few of the panels here, and we had a fantastic all-woman journalist keynote roundtable discussion one of the evenings. Again, and there were so many student-led panels. On the other end of the spectrum, something that we'll be sharing with the Project Censored audience in the near future is we had an historic conversation at the other end of the generational spectrum with Daniel Ellsberg and Peter Dale Scott. Again, I just feel privileged to be part of any of this and working with these students. Izzy and Christina, what's your feedback from some of that work?
It was a lot of work. It was amazing. I don't think we really knew what to expect at the beginning. We just knew like, oh, we're doing a conference. It felt like a total blur until October happened, and then it was doing all the panels. And one thing I really enjoyed about the panels was I would see some of the older people in the audience or even on the panel go up to the students and say, oh, that was amazing. I did not know about that. And that was just such a cool thing to like be involved in.
Well, we're really glad that you were involved in it, because that's how it got pulled off between Susan and the great students there. I mean, it was a really incredible kind of event. Izzy?
I found that my experiences at the Media Freedom Summit really solidified the classroom content and the curriculum that I learned in school, but then expanded upon that. And I was able to see how I can use my voice in a national, in a local, in a communal sense, but then translate that into work with other people. And Christina makes a really interesting point about the intergenerational experience. And I made so many new friends and met so many amazing people. And it just really felt like an incredible opportunity. But it was also just really exciting to see, because you don't really get that experience a lot of times when you're in the classroom. You're inside of the confines of the curriculum. You do the essays, you do the tests, but then you're sort of out of there. But this makes the whole independent news landscape your classroom. And it gives you the tools to sort of empower yourself with skills that are beyond any sort of education or degree or anything like that, but how to conduct yourself as a citizen of the world.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of this ability to take what you learn and share it, which we don't get to do often. I'm reminded of my dissertation that like two people read, right? You write this big sucker and then you're like, I did it. And nobody gets it. Nobody understands, because it's a very insular kind of experience. Whereas all the work that you guys have done and all the conference attendees they've done throughout their careers, then we came together and shared it. And it was so neat to keep the conversation going. And I think that solidarity is really important, because what we know is that it's very easy to succumb to something like just, okay, then I'm just going to, you know, look at BuzzFeed and I'm just going to get on my Facebook and forget about the news. But this reminds everyone that no, actually, it's really important that we're all aware and that we're all sharing ideas and that we're all talking about these things. And whatever each of our individual activism looks like, that we're keeping up with it. Because this is not just to say, wow, we've got so many problems out there. It's like, wow, we've got so many problems out there, and there's work to be done, and I want to do it. And when there's good stuff out there, it's good to share that as well. I think it's invigorating.
I'd like to remind everyone that you're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We have in studio with us today two fantastic student researchers and authors, contributors to Censored 2019, Fighting the Fake News Invasion. They contributed to the Junk Food News chapter. We have Izzy Snow and Christina Hamilton. We also have Professor Susan Rahman with us, who oversaw that chapter with them. After this brief musical break, we're going to come back. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we're focusing on one of the many facets that Project Censored works on in our critical media education programs and our critical pedagogy towards social justice. And this is the focus on infotainment culture, and particularly what we call junk food news. Today in studio, we have Izzy Snow, Christina Hamilton, students at College of Marin that were researchers and authors contributing to Chapter 2 of Censored 2019, Fighting the Fake News Invasion. The chapter is titled Blurred Lines and Clickbait. And Izzy Snow, we mentioned earlier that you also contributed to the book in the first chapter, People Bust Across U.S. to Cut Cities' Homeless Populations. That was one of the validated independent news stories. And so, you know, you're also being really attuned to how censorship works in a country like the United States that purports to have a free press system. And not only do you learn about how censorship works in the junk food chapter, but here you are looking at the independent press and how the corporate press either distorts or ignores it entirely. Do you want to share a couple words about some of the experiences you had with that story?
That was an incredible example of applying the classroom content into a work that I will carry with me for the rest of my life, and the sort of experiences that transcend the classroom environment. And this story really demonstrated how really important news stories are completely censored to protect corporate interest. So this was an investigation by The Guardian that observed homeless relocation programs in major cities in the U.S. It was an 18-month long investigation, and they calculated 34,240 journeys from 2011 to 2017. So what these programs did is they gave the homeless population one-way bus tickets or plane tickets out of the cities. It was designed as a cheap and effective way of cutting homeless populations, and there were no follow-up or job programs, and more than 20,000 homeless people took part in these programs, and 80% of them were moved to cities with a lower median income. An example is San Francisco, which in 2005, the homeless population was 6,250. In 2007, it was 7,600, and 10,570 people were bused out in 12 years. And so this exemplifies the ways that San Francisco uses the data from the bus programs to demonstrate that they are helping the homeless population. So it really just quantifies the ways in which their humanity is taken away from them. They are basically data to benefit the city, and how these sort of social programs don't actually benefit homeless people. They're just a way to get their numbers down.
Such an important story. And of course, that was out of the Guardian of London that you had to go to read about that. So again, in there is another lesson about the importance of independent journalism. And of course, the importance of critical media literacy education to attune us to these kinds of sources that aren't ready at the click, right? When we walk in the door, the corporate media that hands it to you on the platter. We should obviously be suspect of that. Christina Hamilton, anything else you'd like to add here today?
As part of the Media Freedom Summit, and also we had the book launch for the 2019 book when it came out, and I was very fortunate. Again, I work at Copperfields Books, and I was able to have it so that we could host a little mini panel with Mickey and Susan and another professor, as well as other student journalists who contributed to the book. And I think between the whole panel, like, how many bins were represented?
Like,
six or seven.
Yeah, quite a number.
Yeah,
Ken Burrows was there.
Yeah.
And his students, yes.
And his students, they both had multiples in there. And then Kyle Zucker, again, he had the number one story, and he got to talk about that. So that was really cool. And again, it's that whole communal aspect of Project Censored, where it's literally outside the classroom for me, where I got to bring in my work, and I got to bring in students and the community. I've hosted author events before, but never actually been part of the author event. Like, being an author was pretty cool, and just being able to say, hey, that's my book over there, I'm in that book, I helped write that.
All of our book.
Yeah,
that's what's
so
great
just,
about it.
Yeah, so it was just such a cool experience. I'm just so grateful for that.
Andy Lee Roth and I are ever grateful. We feel really honored to work with so many fantastic students and faculty and people in the community. And Susan, just another nod to you and Kyle Zucker, who couldn't be here today. Kyle did have what ended up being the number one story on the global decline in rule of law as basic human rights diminish. And Susan, you were the faculty evaluator of that story. I also want to remind listeners that if you're interested in learning more about how to get involved in the project, whether it's junk food news, news abuse, the media democracy chapter, the VINs in the chapter one censored stories, maybe radio, etc., go to projectcensored.org and get in touch with us. Whether you're an educator, concerned community member, somebody that wants to be involved or already is involved and wants to cross-pollinate with our networks, right? Absolutely get a hold of us. And that's why community radio is such a fantastic resource for us to communicate these things, because you're not going to hear about Project Censored on NPR or PBS, and you're not going to hear about it on the corporate news media. Probably one of the biggest censored stories of the last 43 years the project has been in existence is literally the project itself, which hasn't been mentioned in corporate media very often. So, Susan Rahman, any concluding remarks from you for today's program?
I think just really thank you for bringing this full circle, because this is another piece of that, taking it out into the real world as opposed to just keeping it insular in a classroom. Just for these guys to come here and to talk about what they've done and to give them the opportunity to share and be heard. I mean, I think it's just a really great opportunity. And I am really fortunate to be able to work with such brilliant people. These two women in particular have blown my mind again and again. And I'm just really lucky. I'm really thankful, very privileged. And the project means a lot to me. And I'm so happy I get to share it in the classroom.
And I can only echo Susan's sentiments there with my students at Diablo Valley College and California State University East Bay. We all do what we can to really try to create a better, more informed, and more just society. And it's a team effort. Boy. So I want to thank Izzy Snow, Christina Hamilton, Dr. Susan Rahman. Thank you so much for joining us today again on the Project Censored Show.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
So that does it for another episode of the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, and a reminder to some of our listeners in the audience, KSKQ up in Ashland, Oregon. I will be at Southern Oregon University. I will be there Thursday, April 18th, 7 p.m. I'll also be in town the following day for a meet and greet. And I know KSKQ has played the Project Censored Show for a long time. So if you are in the Ashland-Medford area, hope to see you in mid-April. You've been listening to the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by myself and Peter Phillips. I am the executive producer, Mickey Huff, and host of the program, along with my co-host, Chase Palmieri, who will return with us next week. Anthony Fest is our senior producer. Our associate producer is Dennis Murphy. The Project Censored Show airs on around 50 stations across the United States, from Maui to New York. To learn more about our work and find any of our previous archive programs, go to projectcensored.org. Also, check out our sister podcast, Along the Line. Please follow and like us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and be sure to subscribe to the official Project Censored Show on your cell phone's podcast application. Please feel free to share your feedback about our work. Last but not least, thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.